I present Dr. Charles Wood, Professor of Systematic Theology at Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University, for his opening presentation.
Someone ought to make it clear before things get too much farther along that I take it I'm representing the evolutionist perspective in this inquiry, and Dr. Geisler is representing the creationist perspective. If I'm wrong on that, anyone.
No one told me.
Well, let's see how that function works out. Having said that, I've got to begin by telling you that I'm not at all clear just what position is which I've agreed to represent. Evolutionism sounds like the name of a doctrine, a particular, well-articulated, self-consciously held body of teaching. People who invent or invest themselves in such a doctrine might well call themselves evolutionists, I suppose. Well, I'm not an evolutionist in that sense. I have no particular theological or scientific theory to advocate under that banner, and it wouldn't occur to me normally to identify myself as an evolutionist unless I had to choose the label as the lesser of two evils, and I imagine that's the situation in which I find myself tonight. Of course, labels are not always initially chosen by the bearers, you know. Sometimes they're assigned and not as compliments. Sometimes a label turns out to be one the labeled party is willing to bear with more or less enthusiasm. Labels like Christian and Methodist started out that way, proposed by outsiders but adopted by the person so labeled eventually. Maybe creationists, whoever they are, need a name for those who disagree with them and have chosen to call them evolutionists. If so, I suppose I'm de facto a qualified evolutionist. Let's see. Let me propose for purposes of our discussion tonight a little more stringent definition of evolutionism, the sort of minimal position that I could be talked into confessing if I was pressed. Let me identify three elements of an evolutionary perspective that I'm willing to acknowledge as my own. Then I want to sketch some interesting theological consequences of that perspective. The first element is this. These are going to be very simple and apparently simple-minded statements, I should warn you. The first element is this. Things change. Things change. Change is a pervasive and persistent feature of the universe. Things have come to be the way they are. They haven't always been this way. And things will doubtless go on changing and not remain the way they are now. Let me specify some of the things I'm referring to under the title of things. Planets, stars and star systems and galaxies, oceans and mountain ranges, forms of life, such as we commonly identify as the present species of plant and animal life on Earth, including the human species. All of these evolved in an appropriate sense of the word evolved. That is, they were not suddenly created in their present form, but rather they came to be what they are now through a gradual process of transformation out of previous arrangements of things. And they will go on changing, in all likelihood, in response to the sorts of pressures and opportunities that have produced the present situation. That's the first element. Things change in that broad sense of change. Secondly, in all this change, there's a large element of chance. Things did not have to come to be the way they are. The process of change is not the unfolding of a grand design, the working out in time and space of a script already written. Now, one implication of what I'm saying, naturally, is that humankind did not have to come into existence. Things could have taken quite a different course. Our being is contingent in that respect. Now, many people are accustomed to acknowledging this sort of contingency with respect to their own existence. You or I might not have existed. Most of us are fairly comfortable, although a little solemnized sometimes by that realization. But the point here is, though, that the existence of the whole human species is similarly contingent upon all sorts of prior happenings, none of which had to happen. There's a large element of chance in this process of change. The third and last element of this evolutionary perspective is this. All this change involves vast amounts of time and material. Not just days or centuries, but millions or billions of years. not just this earth or solar system, but a universe whose size and limits are yet unknown, if indeed it makes sense to speak of any absolute limits of either space or time. The amount of space and time occupied by the human adventure is, in its entirety, minute. Now, it's obvious that the evolutionary perspective I've characterized with these three elements is in conflict with some beliefs that many people have taken to be involved in Christian faith. One of the most serious upheavals in modern Christian thought and experience was produced by the impact of this evolutionary perspective upon the minds of Christians in the second half of the 19th century, and that upheaval is obviously continuing. It challenged certain aspects of the inherited cosmology within which Christians had articulated their beliefs up to that time. For example, the notion that the universe, including this earth with its present forms of living things, including the human species, that this universe was created a few thousand years ago within the span of a week. The notion that everything which exists was created deliberately and especially by God to serve some purpose within the divine plan, and that those things which were created have for the most part persisted in existence without noticeable change. And the notion that humankind occupies the central position in that plan, that the world is the theater, as John Calvin likes to put it, in which the human drama unfolds, and the universe exists really for the sake of the human invention. Now, given this obvious incompatibility between an evolutionary perspective and such beliefs as this, one has, I suppose, at least four options. First, one could renounce the Christian faith. One could decide that the beliefs thus challenged were so inherent a part of the Christian affirmation that they could not be sacrificed, and that the evolutionary perspective was correct, and thus renounce the Christian faith. Secondly, one could renounce or reject the evolutionary perspective, rule that it simply was false. Third, one could modify the evolutionary perspective so that it's compatible with what one takes the faith to require. Vary one's evolutionary perspective so as to include elements of Christian doctrine sufficient to guarantee that one could hold them both without schizophrenia. Fourth, one could modify Christian belief or doctrine so that they are consistent with the evolutionary perspective. Granted the truth of the evolutionary perspective in some broad sense, then it's obviously the Christian belief that needs to be revised. Now, of course, options three and four can also be combined. One can attempt to revise both the tenets of evolutionism and those of Christianity so as to reconcile them. All of those options have, in fact, been pursued by sizable numbers of persons confronted with this conflict. I want to pursue the fourth option for the next few minutes, partly because that's my assignment, partly because I believe it to be the most promising. That was the option of modifying Christian doctrine so as to render them consistent with an evolutionary view. A possibility of making such modifications or revisions rests on our being able to recognize a fundamental distinction with regard to Christian doctrine. Fundamental distinction. This is the distinction between, to put it in one of the forms it could be put in, distinction between what is said and what is meant. That's a distinction with which we normally have very little difficulty. We all acknowledge that there may be different ways of saying the same thing, and different forms of expression for the same content. And we also recognize the close interdependence of what is said and what is meant. That is, on the one hand, there are better and worse ways of saying what you mean in a given situation. And on the other hand, at any given time, your ways of saying what you mean are limited. And the common task we all have, more or less consciously, is to find a way to put what we mean which will be most transparent to what we mean and least open to misconstrual. That distinction between what is said and what is meant is fundamental to the pursuit of the option I'm trying to explore. The possibility of revising Christian doctrine so as to take account of an evolutionary perspective rests, I say, upon our ability and willingness to recognize and to apply that distinction. To apply it first to the Bible itself, since the Bible is held to be in some sense normative for Christian doctrine, and then secondly, to apply it to the doctrines themselves. I'm going to pass over the first of those tasks, although it's crucial, because discussing it would involve us in raising a number of issues not directly pertinent to our theme tonight. And I'll go on to the second, where the consequences of evolutionism might be more readily seen. Let me just sketch out for a moment some of the implications which might follow from revising Christian doctrine in the direction of an evolutionary perspective. The area in which doctrinal revision seems most necessary and most pertinent is in the area of the doctrine of creation and providence, doctrine or doctrines of creation and providence. One of the effects that an evolutionary perspective has upon this area of doctrine, as it's been applied, is to make more clear in the minds of those who are doing this revising, at least, what the intention of the doctrine of creation is. That is, under the impact of the evolutionary perspective, at least, it becomes apparent that the aim of the doctrine of creation is not to be a theory about the origins of the world. It's not to be a scientific hypothesis about the way things got to be the way they are. But it's rather to be a statement about God's relationship to the world, a statement which helps us relate ourselves appropriately to God and the world. It doesn't necessarily apply anything about how things got to be the way they are in terms of causality and process of change or the bringing into being of what there is. It's a statement about the relation between God and the world, which helps us to relate ourselves appropriately in that world. The evolutionary perspective in this regard has the impact of reorienting the doctrine of creation to what many consider to be its real intention. Now, let me get a little more specific about aspects of this doctrine of creation or providence, creation and providence, which are also impacted. It seems to me that one of the major contributions of an evolutionary perspective to the reformulation of a Christian doctrine of creation and providence is this. It corrects a pervasive, long-standing anthropocentrism within Christian doctrine, an anthropocentrism with regard to the relative importance of human beings and other creatures in creation. It's commonly held in the Christian church that things other than human beings have only an instrumental value. That is, their value is relative to their importance for us and their usefulness to us. If one takes an evolutionary perspective seriously, one realizes that this sort of anthropocentrism, the centering of the universe in the human project, is a gross distortion. That rather, other things have a being and a value for God in and of themselves. That the human task with regard to the rest of creation is not simply to use it to our own ends, but to care for it, to cherish it, to regard it and value it in the way appropriate to its own importance for God. Now, that's quite a corrective when you realize some of the implications of the opposing view. There is a high government official who remains nameless, who appears to hold the position that since Jesus is coming soon, our real task is to use up the earth as soon as we can, so as to show our respect for it. Second thing that I will mention just very briefly, second sort of impact or corrective that evolutionary perspective can give to the Christian doctrine of creation and providence, it gives human beings a freedom to change and to be changers, which they may not have fully appropriated under the old doctrine of creation, according to which things were pretty well fixed the way they are and the way they're meant to be. It brings home the message that we have responsibility for creating our own future, that we are shapers of history and to a great extent now shapers of the part of nature with which we come into contact. Things don't have to be the way they are. That was one aspect of my basic evolutionary perspective. When you boil that down to a matter of how that bears upon human conduct, it means Things don't have to be the way they are. We are free to change the situation in which we find ourselves rather than accepting it as a given. We have the freedom to become, in a sense, co-creators with God in the process which we and God share. I think I've been entirely too simple in laying this out, but I think we need to start somewhere. With that, I'll close.
Dr. Geisler, Professor of Systematic Theology from Dallas Theological Seminary, will represent, if my assumptions are correct,
thank you very much. I would like to speak first of all to the scientific aspects and then to the theological and ethical aspects of the topic. There are two scientific approaches to the question. One has to do with scientific approach to the present, in which observation and repetition are key scientific concepts. If we can't observe it in some way, or if we can't repeat it, it's not the subject of scientific law in the present. So empirical science, in the strict sense, deals only with the observational and the repetitional. But when we deal with past events, we have no observation, and the events of origins were not repeated. The universe only happened once, at least in observational time. First, life began only once, and the whole process of the development of life happened only once. So we do not have either observation or repetition of the events of origin to work with. Therefore, we're cast upon two other scientific principles, the principle of causality and the principle of uniformity. When dealing with past events, we assume that every event had a cause, and we assume that what we see in the present is the key to understanding the past. So if certain causes are adequate in the present, they would be adequate in the past. If other causes are adequate in the present, they would be adequate in the past. Now, with that in mind, there are two kinds of causes one can postulate. Natural causes or supernatural causes that logically exhaust the possibilities. A natural cause could be either a designed natural cause or it could be a not designed natural cause. I take it that theistic evolution would be the first and atheistic evolution would be the second. Now, the difference between a natural law as a cause of an event of origin and a supernatural law would be something like this. Waterfalls is explainable by natural laws. Precipitation, evaporation, condensation, gravity will explain a waterfall. But a hydroelectric plant is not explainable by purely natural laws. That takes intelligent intervention to get a hydroelectric plant out of a waterfall. Wind erosion can be explained by natural laws. But a windmill cannot be explained apart from intelligent intervention. So when I speak of creation, I'm talking about intelligent intervention that would not have occurred unless there is intelligent intervention that the natural laws would not have produced. For example, there's a vast difference between the Grand Canyon, which I take it can be explained by natural laws. The natural laws of erosion can explain the Grand Canyon, the softer rock being washed away by the river, etc. And I wouldn't think that it would take intelligent intervention to explain the topology or the geology of the Grand Canyon. On the other hand, I would assume that it would take intelligent intervention to account for that. So that the difference between the Grand Canyon is that you can explain the Grand Canyon by the natural laws of erosion. You cannot explain Mount Rushmore by the laws of erosion unless they're political erosion. With that in mind, let me suggest that there are two views of origins, and there are three parts of the debate of origin. There's a natural cause or a supernatural cause, and what the debate is today is about whether or not it is legitimate to refer to supernatural causes, or must we limit science only to natural causes? And we have three main areas of the debate: the universe, first forms of life and new life forms. So let's apply it to each of these areas of the debate. First of all, the origin of the universe, there are really only two possibilities. Either the universe had no beginning or it had a beginning. That again pretty well exhausts the logical. If the universe had a beginning, either there was no cause or there was a cause. That again pretty well takes care of the options. Now with respect to science, one of the fundamental principles of science has been the law of causality. David Hume is supposed to have attacked that. Most people are ignorant of the fact that David Hume himself denies it. He said, "But allow me to tell you that I never asserted so absurd a proposition as that anything might arise without a cause. I only maintain that our certainty of the falsehood of that proposition proceeds neither from intuition nor demonstration, but from another source." Notice, David Hume says it is absurd to deny the principle of causality, and the principle of causality is certain. Okay? Any person knows that nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. So every event must have a cause. Let's apply this to the origin of the universe. I recommend a book by an astronomer who makes no particular claims about religion. In fact, I think he claims to be agnostic, Robert Jastrow, God and the Astronomers. Here's what he says about the astronomical evidence, scientific evidence with regard to the origin of the universe. Now we see how the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The details differ, but the essential elements in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis are the same. The chain of events leading to man commenced suddenly and sharply at a definite moment in time in a flash of light and energy. He uses several principles, the expanding universe, the radiation echo, the second law of thermodynamics, and he says almost the last skeptic has been converted to believe that the universe began suddenly some billions of years ago. In the last paragraph of his book, he says this, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled a mountain of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for some time." Now let's apply it to the origin of life. There are only two alternatives with regard to the origin of life. Spontaneous generation, no intelligent intervention, purely natural laws, or special creation, intelligent intervention. One is the primeval soup theory. And it doesn't matter whether the soup is here in outer space and it came here from outer space, it just transfers at one point. Life had to begin by spontaneous generation, natural laws, or by some kind of intelligent intervention wherever it began, if it began here on Earth. Now, one of the theories that has existed due to the experiments of Urey and Miller is that you can, by putting electricity through certain basic chemicals, produce amino acids, which are the building blocks of life, and the building blocks of life can evolve in that fashion by a natural law. What is not widely known, however, is that there, in fact, no such materials have been found anywhere on Earth. And I'm not quoting from a creationist there, I'm quoting from an evolution scientist. That is, nowhere on Earth have any such materials been found. A curious flaw of human nature is to permit the imagery of a catchy phrase to shape one's reasoning. Haldane's hot Duluth soup became primordial soup, a feature that has been popularized for nearly 50 years without geological evidence that it ever existed. No evidence whatsoever geologically for the primeval soup. Furthermore, when they reconstruct in the laboratory the experiment to produce the elements of life, which is a long way from life, the chemicals they use are generally on an order of 1 million times more concentrated than found anywhere on Earth. That's intelligent manipulation, even to get as far as they have gotten. Let me quote from Herbert Yockey in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. "The warm little pond scenario was invented ad hoc to serve as a materialistic, reductionist explanation of the origin of life. It is unsupported by any other evidence, and it will remain ad hoc until such evidence is found. One must conclude that contrary to the established and current wisdom, a scenario describing the genesis of life on Earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact and not faith, has not yet been written." One of the reasons for that is this little thing called the DNA. That is a electronic microscope picture of a DNA done by an advanced researcher here in Dallas, who again doesn't claim to be a creationist, but the DNA is splitting at that particular point. And the question arises, why
DNA, and what's all of this information? There is enough information in the simplest form of life to fill a whole volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That is, there's enough information in one single simple cell animal to fill a whole volume of an encyclopedia. Now I ask you, can that be accounted for by natural law? The answer is yes. Can that be accounted for without intelligent intervention? The answer is no. Now, if the information reflected on that mountainside demands an intelligent creator, then the information reflected in this DNA also demands an intelligent creator. And Herbert Yockey has proven now in the Journal of Biology that the information theory developed by the Bell Laboratories has exact mathematical correspondence in the DNA. Now, if that's true, then the information in the DNA reflects an intelligence behind it, just as the information on that reflects an intelligence. A creationist simply wants to say, look, it takes intelligent intervention to account for something. It doesn't take intelligent intervention to account for other things. Life is one of the things that it takes intelligent intervention for. Let's apply this to the origin of new forms of life. Here again, there are only two possibilities. Evolution, no intelligent intervention, and creation, intelligent intervention. Now, the difference between an evolutionary view and a creationist view is this. Evolutionists believe in common ancestry. Everything is traceable to one trunk back to one root. So it's like one tree. Creationists believe in separate ancestry. There are different trees. It's like a forest. They do believe in branches on the trees, what is generally called microevolution. That is, small changes occur. That's a matter of observation. Darwin observed this, and Darwin proved that microevolution is a fact. But macroevolutionary changes have never been observed, and there is no reason to believe, either from the paleontological record or from experience in a laboratory, that macroevolutionary changes ever occurred. And a creationist says, I posit a whole forest of trees with variation within meaningful kinds, but no evolution between the kinds. What would an example of evolution between kinds be? The cow is supposed to have given rise to the whale, according to evolutionists, because blood serum tests show that the closest land animal to a whale is a cow. They're both mammals, and so the cow is supposed to have gone out to sea somehow in the sea learned to swim long enough to produce and to evolve into a whale. And I think any reasonable person can see that there is a whale of a difference. The only place you will ever see the phylogenetic tree is in the page of a textbook of an evolutionist, because that tree doesn't exist. All the branches are drawn. There are gigantic gaps in the evolutionary record. Now, what does a creationist say to support this? First thing he points to is the paleontological record. There's what the fossils show. The fossils show life beginning abundantly and suddenly, every basic kind in the Cambrian period, new life forms beginning with no transitional fossils, and great leaps between all of the various kinds. Now, if there is a creator of the universe and of first life, then there's no reason why we can't say that when you get a new book, a simple little book with one volume of information, when you get a new book with many volumes of information, it takes intelligent intervention to do that. For example, the human brain, the information in the human brain, quoting from Carl Sagan, Cosmos, page 278, is equivalent to the Library of Congress, the genetic information in the brain. Now, I'd say from one volume of an encyclopedia to the Library of Congress is a great leap. And to think that one volume evolved into another without intelligent intervention takes more faith than to believe in God. In terms of Dr. Colin Patterson, the head paleontologist at the British Museum, who said there is no evidence for the gradual change of life. And in a speech on November 5th, 1981, here's what Dr. Patterson said. The explanatory value of the hypothesis of common ancestry is nil. No explanatory value of evolution. Evolution not only conveys no knowledge, but somehow conveys anti-knowledge. How could I work on evolution 20 years and learn nothing from it? Gillespie's comment, a void that has the function of knowledge but conveys none, seems to me very precise, very apt. There's not a shred of evidence for macroevolution. He said, I've been deceived for 20 years and shocked the scientific community. Now let me say a word about the implications religiously of the doctrine of evolution. Darwin said, I must remain agnostic as a result of the belief in evolution. His co-founder, Wallace, said, natural selection is supreme. He had used it to replace God. Huxley said, you can explain everything by blind chance and force. Hitler said, you can even justify the superiority of the Aryan race on the basis of evolution. The Humanist Manifesto says that you can justify humanism on the basis of the doctrine of evolution. Now I ask you, are those implications properly drawn from the theory of evolution? My answer would be no. None of those implications are justifiably drawn from a scientific theory. But if you cannot draw those religious and ethical implications from the scientific theory of evolution, neither can you draw religious or ethical implication from the Christian doctrine of creation.
Let's proceed now to 5 minutes of response time for each of our principal presenters, following which you are invited to submit questions on the cards that members of the Religious Studies Club of SMU have, I hope, graciously provided. I have the impression that my counterpart here has been through this sort of thing before. I don't know about you, but I found that going by this fast. I'm not sure I could follow enough of it intelligently enough to enable a response that will amount to much. Let me start out, though, by saying that I understood by the ground rules of our discussion tonight that we were not primarily to be dealing with the question of the scientific status of the evolutionary and creationist hypotheses, many as they are, but rather with the theological implications of the position once described. I'm not sure I got a very clear impression from what Mr. Geisler had to say, just what position is he minded to defend and develop the theological implications of. I have a rough idea, but I'm not at all sure I've got the thing clearly in mind. Maybe he can help us out with that later on. And despite this, what I told some of my students this afternoon, we're not here tonight to debate the question that's going to face that little gorilla recently born in the Dallas Zoo. Am I my keeper's brother? I find it a little odd for someone to assume that the business of debating scientific hypotheses and their relative merits is the proper province of theologians. If we were to have a debate on the scientific evidence for or against creationism or any of various evolutionary theories, I should think the proper people to debate that would be properly qualified geologists, paleontologists, biologists, and the like. So I'm out of my competence and I simply will not bite. Mr. Jackson, you well feel indeed qualified to speak as a creation scientist. But this is something totally out of my depth, at least. I'd be most interested in hearing some more about the theological and ethical implications of this. Mr. Jackson made a statement toward the end of his speech about how inferences could or could not be properly drawn from the two opposing perspectives he was getting. I wasn't sure that I understood exactly what his point was or how it bore on our debate. I'd like to know more about that. I think so. I'm not going to pursue this any farther with my time and surrender whatever time there is to Mr. Geisler to develop his own response. All right. Dr. Geisler?
One of the charges that's generally made about creation science is there's no scientific basis for it. And one of the reasons that I explicitly asked and was granted by the people who invited me here to speak to the scientific aspect of it was because that's a charge made. There is no scientific basis for creation science. I think I tried to illustrate how that is wrong. Furthermore, from 1620 to 1860, most scientists were creation scientists. What's generally forgotten is that Christianity is the mother of science, as Alfred North Whitehead said, and Foster, in an article in Mind, 1934, showed that without the Christian doctrine of creation, there would be no modern science. So if the Christian doctrine of creation is the basis for modern science, if the first scientists, most of them for 240 years, were creation scientists, Kelvin, Kepler, Newton, Pascal, just to mention a few people, then I find it strange for modern evolutionists to say that creationism is not scientific. Secondly, there are only two alternatives, as I showed. Either you take a natural law explanation or a supernatural law, and for someone to say there are only two alternatives, and I realize there are two alternatives, and the other one might be right, but you can't teach the other one in public schools, I think it's your bigotry. I think it's a loss of academic freedom, and that's why I was a happy participant at the Creation Evolution Trial in Little Rock, Arkansas, where I saw reverse bigotry go on. In 1925, there were fundamentalist bigots who said you can only teach one view in the public schools. In 1982, there are humanist bigots who say you can only teach one view in the public schools. I find that equally obnoxious. If there are two views, why can you only teach one? If the original scientists were creationists, why now, as Voltaire said, it's kind of like the anthill with the black ants on the black anthill, the brown ants on the brown anthill, and the black ants on the black anthill are looking over at the brown ants and saying, they are an ant, and that's not an anthill. The evolution of science, they're looking over at the creation scientists and say, they aren't scientists, and that's not science. Well, of course, that's one way to cover up your bigotry. And that's why I'm very concerned, and that is a serious ethical implication of the issue. There are also religious and ethical implications. Hitler used the doctrine of evolution to prove that the Aryan race was superior and to justify bloodshed of the Jews in the name of natural selection. Now, any reasonable person, it seems to me, would look at that and say, that is not a justifiable implication of the scientific doctrine of evolution. And if that is not justifiable to draw those kind of implications from evolution, then it's not justifiable for the people of our day to look at the doctrine of creation and say, see, they're trying to teach a fundamentalist ethic and fundamentalist theology in the public school. We're trying to teach science, the other half of the story. And if somebody draws those implications, he's just as guilty as Hitler for drawing the wrong implications from the theory of evolution. That's, I think, a very serious implication. Let me speak directly to what Dr. Wood said. Most of what he said, I think, is correct, but misses the main points that I'm trying to make. He articulated his view on evolution. He articulated that he believed in chance and natural law as a horizontal cause here. And then he said, we must revise the doctrine of creation in the light of that. I see no reason to revise the biblical doctrine of creation in the light of anything in science. I see no reason whatsoever. All that Genesis says is there was a creator. He did create the universe. He did create basic kinds of life. It doesn't say that those kinds were absolutely fixed. It doesn't say there was no variation within them. It doesn't say the time he took to do it. I think all of that is perfectly compatible. I see nothing in Genesis that has to be revised in the light of any fact of modern science. Surely we don't have to throw out the doctrine of creation in the light of any so-called microevolutionary evidence. Another thing I want to point out is there's a difference between the doctrine of providence and the doctrine of creation. When we're talking about should origins be taught in the public school, we're not talking about should we teach the doctrine of God sustaining the universe now. That's a perfectly legitimate doctrine. But we should not reduce creation to providence or confuse creation and providence. They're two separate doctrines. The doctrine of creation of the universe is always referred to in the past tense. The word create is used in the present. But the doctrine of the origin of the universe and life is always from the beginning. It was not so. Before the foundation of the world, God in the beginning made them. This is a past tense thing. And the laws that explain the operation of the universe do not account for the origin. You can account for the operation of a clock. by the laws of tension and gravity and motion. But you cannot account for the origination of a cloud by those laws. It takes intelligence to originate them. And that's what we're saying. Operation of the universe, natural laws. Origination of the universe, you can't account for it any more than erosion accounts for Mount Rushmore.
Thank you, Dr. Geisler. My understanding of Dr. Wood's relinquishing of 2 minutes of his time was that it would be added to your time for response. If that is the correct assumption, you still have 2 minutes. You have saved to this audience 2 minutes. I think some of the issues are squarely before us. There may be some questions which arise out of the statements made by both of these theologians tonight. And we come now to a time when you have an opportunity to interact with them. I think it's impossible for everyone to ask a question and to expect a response tonight. Part of my background is immersed enough in sociology to be really interested to see the demographics of our audience tonight. By a show of hands.
That's not fair.
We have an objection to that question. Let me put that in another vein. On behalf of the Religious Studies Club at SMU, I extend, on behalf of them, a hearty welcome to all our guests who come from other institutions in the city, particularly for Balanced Theological, where Dr. Geisler is a professor, and those of you who are from SMU acting as host tonight, I invite you to give a warm applause and welcome to our guest.
I think that is a very unfair and subtle way to categorize the audience.
I'm a housewife.
You're okay, I'll Dr. Geisler, what did you mean by Genesis not speaking to the issue of time, of the time, quote, time, it took for God to create? And then a clarification, it seems like there are some very time terms in Genesis 1:3.
Somebody asked a question, I said I thought I would bring my Bible. There are some time terms in Genesis chapter 1. It says, in the beginning. The only thing Genesis 1 irrevocably commits us to believe, if we believe the Bible, and I most assuredly do believe the Bible, the only thing it commits us to believe is that the universe is not eternal, that it had a beginning. It does not say when the beginning was. It does not say how long it was. It doesn't say how many gaps there may or may not have been. Anyone who studies biblical chronology knows that you can't add up all of the chronologies and genealogies in Genesis 5 and 10 because there are demonstrable gaps there. There are possible gaps between the days, before the days. The days could be long periods of time. Creationists are not committed to any given time of the creation of the universe. Could be billions of years, it could be thousands of years. We're open to arguments on both sides. Evolutionists, on the other hand, are irrevocably committed to believing the universe must be billions of years old. Because if it is short, that blows their theory. It doesn't affect us at all if the earth is old or the earth is young. We want both arguments taught in the public schools. Let me tell you why. A creation scientist on a young earth model has just invented a fossil fuel that powers a car across the United States at one-third the price of gasoline. Do you think the newspapers reported this from the Arkansas tribe? No, they reported the religious beliefs of the creationists, that they believed in demons and UFOs, not the revolutionary scientific inventions of that. That's unfair.
And restate it. What did you mean by Genesis not speaking to the issue of the time it took for God to create? Dr. Geisler's answer to this question illustrates my previous observation that he had not spelled out very clearly, to my mind at least, exactly what the creationist, his version, holds. I believe I understood him to say just now that a theory that stated that the earth was created billions of years ago was entirely compatible with creationism. Did I understand it correctly? Then I need more illumination as to exactly what creationism does and does not involve as a scientific hypothesis. I know that at least certain versions of creationism hold to what the Arkansas law belief describes as a relatively recent origin for the earth, interpreted as, what, less than 10,000 years ago or something of the sort, and that there are major creationist bodies which do indeed hold to, a more conventional creationist dating of the earth's origin from that. In the discussion of the of microevolution, of the separate ancestry and of the length of time that the world came to be in, I'm not at all sure just where Dr. Geisler and I actually do differ. I've got some suspicions as to some of the areas in which we differ, and they would be largely theological. I have yet to know where we differ as far as the perspective is concerned.
Dr. Wood, a question. If man is simply a product of change and chance, what is the basis for morality? An example, by way of two additional questions. Why should I feel any different about killing you than I'm killing a bug? And is law only the powerful imposing their rules on others not in power?
Did I see the cards for that? Yes, if man is simply a product of chance and not change, chance and change, what is the basis for morality? There are a number of logical leaps to be covered before one can begin to answer that question, I suppose. To say that chance is a large element in the evolutionary process, as I tried to suggest in one of my elements of the evolutionary perspective, is not to say that all is chance, or that there is no value realized through the process of evolution. The questioner presupposes that morality is somehow tied to determinism, or to a theory that things are governed by some kind of destiny. I suspect maybe the question about killing a bug or killing me is a way to specify the issue here. Yeah. So it does. I eat. The fact that both bugs and human beings emerge in the process, which includes a large element of chance, doesn't mean that there are no important differences between bugs and human beings. Human beings are obviously a more complex form of life, open to a great many more responses to the world and to their creator. Able to receive and respond to life in ways that bugs are not so able, and thus, on one way of construing value, of more value. So I wouldn't have the slightest compunction telling you to feel quite some difference trying to make up the decision which of us to kill.
First of all, chance doesn't cause anything. Chance is the intersection of two lines of causality. If someone causes treasure to be hid in the field, that's a causal act. If a farmer causes his plow to go by there and unearth the treasure, we call that a chance finding. But the farmer caused that to go by there, and the person caused it to be hid there. Chance didn't cause anything. It's just the intersection of two lines of causality. Secondly, chance does not account for the origin of Mount Rushmore. No natural laws or processes of chance can account for that, and no amount of time, if you took colored pieces of paper and dropped them from an airplane at 10,000 feet, they would never spell your name on your roof. If you took them 20,000 feet and gave them more time, they're less likely to spell your name on your roof. It takes intelligent intervention. That's what creation is for.
Dr. Geisler, does a creationist position necessarily entail a young earth and the recent creation of man?
The creationist position does not necessarily entail a young earth, but a creationist position, in all fairness to the scientific evidence, does entail the right to present the evidence for a young earth, which is not presently possible. Furthermore, the Arkansas law did not say that a young earth is the point of view that must be taught. The Arkansas law was eminently fair. If you'd like to have a documentary account of it, I just happened to have a book with me called The Creator in the Courtroom, which is a documentary account that we did of the Arkansas trial. Here's what the bill said. If you teach evolution, you must teach creation. If you teach creation, you must teach evolution. You cannot refer to religious documents, and you must teach both sides of every issue. If you present the evidence for a long earth, you must present the evidence for a young earth. If you present uniformitarianism, you must present catastrophism. If you present evolution, you must present creation. I would think that would be a very fair way to approach it. But no, time is not the essence of a creationist view. You're looking at creationists right here who believes the universe is billions of years old.
Dr. Woods,
since Dr. Geisler referred to a document on the Arkansas events, I ought to refer you to one that will be accessible to most of you in the library, at least, the March-April 1982 issue of Academe, which is the Journal of the American Association of University Professors. Has extensive documentation on the Arkansas case, including a full text of the opinion attended by the judge, the final ruling in that, and that's a presentation worth your attention. He keeps reverting to this issue of the schools and creationism in the schools. I've got a colleague who teaches New Testament, Perkins, who shall we say, firmly holds to the view that the Gospel of Matthew was the first Gospel written. It was written before Mark. Now that's counter to the established consensus in critical New Testament scholarship, according to which Mark is the prior Gospel. Matthew and Luke depended on Mark as one of their literary sources. Now my colleague, so far as I'm aware, does not proceed to advocate his view by attempting to lobby seminaries to give equal time to his position, to pressure the educational institutions that have to do with teaching religion in public institutions of higher education to be sure to include Matthean priority in their curriculum. He doesn't pretend that there are only two sides to this issue at all, nor does he pretend that the place to begin a serious scientific debate, which is what this one is too, on the issue of Matthean or Markan priority is to begin with what is in this instance analogous to elementary education. He recognizes the proper forum in which to advocate his own concern is the scholarly guild of New Testament scholarship. And so he presents papers of working groups of appropriate New Testament scholars in the American Academy of Religion, the Society of Biblical Literature, and so on. He attempts to gain his own points in the scholarly consensus. He tries to make a dent, and he has certainly made a dent. That is, his theory is getting a much wider hearing than it got some time ago. Now, he feels some of the same suspicions with regard to the scholarly consensus in New Testament studies that I think Dr. Geisler and his colleagues feel with regard to the scientific consensus. That is, both recognize a sort of establishment inertia, a desire not to but be troubled by errant or seemingly errant opinions, a desire to keep things on an even keel. That's just a natural feature of human nature. But he does not attempt to subvert the processes of scientific or scholarly inquiry and to somehow legislate the introduction of his views at a level where they cannot be given the sort of scientific scrutiny and impartial hearing that they rightly deserve. I suppose that's my fundamental objection to the view advocated by the Arkansas law and those who would support it. And I think it's a weighty view.
Dr. Wood, who is the final authority in your corrective anthropology, man or God? A collateral question, what is your definition of good? What is your definition of good?
Find some hard ones. Who's the final authority in your corrective anthropology, man or God? Well, the first thing I've got to say is that, contrary to received opinions, God is not an authority. God is the source of authority. An authority is someone or something which is authorized. God is, in most standard Christian understandings of theological authority, the source of theological authority. That source is located for us as Christians in Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is at once the source of authority and, in one sense, the authorized object. He is God's self-word, as some scholars like to put it. So Jesus Christ is the authorizer. All right, I'll continue to work this on out for a moment. Holy Scripture, as the canon by which the Christian community judges the rightness of its witness and its belief, is the primary authority. That is, Scripture is rightly understood when it's understood as a collection of documents which is divinely authorized to disclose God's self and God's will to humankind. And now that I've worked down that far, I must say, the final authority in my corrective anthropology, so far as the correctness of the witness I would propose to develop in this line, would be Scripture. Now, that says quite a bit, but it doesn't yet say all that needs to be said on this issue, because obviously there are manifold ways of interpreting Scripture as authorized by God. So I haven't done anything more than to lay out the formal structure of an answer to the question. Next, we would have to ask how I would understand those texts as authorized by God, and if I were to try to develop a theory of the authority of Scripture in that regard, I'd appeal to the distinction that I referred to in my opening presentation between what is said and what is meant. And I would insist that we need to understand the Scripture as authoritative with respect to its theme, that is, as authoritative with respect to that which is intended to be conveyed through it,